Welcome back to the homilies of St. Azanus, the recycled saint. Now I've got a very unusual homily for you today, and a bit longer than usual. It's actually a sermon I preached at my own church, wherein I publicly tell the story of my own asininity for the first time. It was not a sermon I particularly wanted to give, but it was time. I'm not actually sure of my motive in offering it here. Am I trying to give my own version of the events that took me out of my teaching ministry? I sure hope not. But I'd be lying if I said that part of me isn't always wanting that. No, I really do hope that in hearing this story, those of you who've got things you regret in your past will realize that you're not alone and that your journey isn't over. And if you're one of those people who've ever watched someone else self-destruct, well, maybe it'll give you something to think about as well.
Good morning. I think the last time I was introduced here, I was introduced something like the random guy who teaches sometimes. And I've decided I really like the title, so I'm going to adopt it. That's literally it. I'm a random guy who teaches sometimes. I like it because I've actually spent a good deal of my life being the random guy who stands around doing stuff. So why not just continue the trend? In fact, I remember when I was in seminary, this would be 20 years ago now, I was a youth pastor, and I think most seminarians end up being a youth pastor. It's maybe like a requirement of some kind that you have to get through. You've got to spend time being a youth pastor. And I was wretched as a youth pastor. I was the world's worst youth pastor. And I remember taking my kids to the first big Christian concert that they'd ever, you know, that they'd ever been to, that we'd ever gone to together. And I learned the hard way that you don't just in youth groups say, hey, who wants to go to a concert? And then all the hands go up, and then you buy that many tickets. Because what ends up happening is you end up being random guy standing on the sidewalk trying to hawk tickets. Because four kids actually showed up because they didn't have any skin in the game. And they and the leaders go in, and then you've stuck with 10 tickets of kids who just didn't bother to show because, well, he didn't ask for any money, so. And so as I'm standing there on the sidewalk trying to get rid of these tickets to this not sold out show, the door on the side of the building opens and the security guard comes out, and he's got two teenage girls in tow. The one of them is going meekly along, you know, she's guilty and she knows it, and her look on her face is, dad's going to kill me when I get home. I mean, it's that sort of thing. I don't know what they were doing, stage diving, something to get you kicked out of a concert. The other one is not going quietly. She chose the hard way. And she is screaming at the top of her lungs as he drags her across the parking lot saying, how dare you? You shouldn't tell me how to worship my God. I'll worship my God any way I want. It's my God, I'll worship God any way I want. All the way across the parking lot with an occasional expletive dropped in just for emphasis. Now, of course, I was in seminary, so the first thing that went through my mind was something incredibly cynical. Like the story from the Old Testament where the two priests, Nadab and Abihu, I looked it up, and they offer the incense kind of out of order, in the wrong place, kind of out of their own thing, and the fire comes out of the tabernacle and like consumes them. And I thought to myself, well, apparently God cares how God is worshipped sometimes. Apparently the barn doors aren't completely open. There's something that, you know, there's a box there somewhere. I'm not saying how big it is, but no fire came down. The thing that actually has stuck with me from that story that I've reflected upon a number of times over my life was the last words I heard as they took her into the outbuilding, whatever, took them in, and the door was creaking closed behind them. Out of the dark hole came this final cry, plaintively, stop judging me! Slam. And I've reflected on that a lot as over the last 20 years I've watched the culture around us get more and more sensitive to the language of judging. Don't judge me. Why are you judging me? Stop judging me. I think what the culture means by it is something like to draw a negative conclusion about someone from a superficial association. Based on how they dress, or their social class, or their employment, or lack thereof, whether they're a vegan or a CrossFitter or whatever. In fact, we found out last week that between the North Campus and the South Campus, we actually have a couple of pastors who self-identify as hipster. I'm not judging. Yo, he's on his cell phone. What good is he? But you see how the game works. It's this idea of when your biases cause you to treat someone differently than you should. Now, I'll admit, I actually think there's some value in this perspective. And I agree, as a general rule, we would all be better off if we not do this. Why? Because it's generally inaccurate. It's usually pretty unfair. You don't know the person. You're just looking at them from the outside. And it is always uncharitable. A failure to think all the good that you can about another person. And I agree, we would probably all be better off if we did it less. But if we bring this cultural perspective to Jesus' words today, we are going to miss the larger and deeper point that Jesus wants to make. In fact, we're going to go too shallow. We will not go deeply enough. Because we're thigh deep now in our study on the Sermon on the Mount, here in Matthew 5 to 7, this long sermon that Jesus gives. And today we've come to the beginning of chapter 7, verse 1, where Jesus offers some of his most famous words. Even if you've not been in church much at all, you've probably heard words a lot like this. They're very famous. Do not judge so that you will not be judged. For in the way you judge, you will be judged. And by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you. Why do you look at the speck that's in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that's in your own? Or how can you say to your brother, let me take that speck, that little whatever, out of your eye, but behold, there's a log in your own eye. You hypocrite, first get the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. Now, if we want to understand Jesus' point in the matter, we've got to continue to keep the context of the Sermon on the Mount in front of us and everything he's been saying. Do not read this as just an isolated proverb. This is not just another variant of never judge a man until you have walked a mile in his moccasins, as true as that may be. Rather, it's more of the same thing Jesus has been doing for the last couple of chapters. He is describing what kingdom citizens are like, how they live, how they move in the world. He is describing, admittedly, here through a negative example, what it is like to see the world through those absolute values of his Father's name, his Father's will, and his Father's kingdom. So we have here less of a sort of a law to be obeyed, and more an invitation to be a particular kind of person. But what sort of person? How are we going to explain this? Now, by way of confession, I have been praying and meditating and talking to people and fighting and battling inside for about a month or so on how best to approach this. The battle has not been really the how, it's been the fact that I don't want to. And God will not let me escape from the notion that I have been uniquely blessed with a story that I think makes Jesus' real point here clear. It's not a story I want to tell. In fact, it's not a story I've told publicly. Well, that's not true. I did it in previous service. But I've not told it at length at any point before today, and I really don't want to. In fact, I would rather have my nasal cavities packed with Limburger than tell the story I'm about to tell. It's a sad story, but it's got a happy ending, I think, for most. And it's that ending alone is the reason I tell it. Because it's one thing to hear the words of Jesus explained, and it's quite another to see them embodied in the lives of people. It's a parable of sorts. It's a true parable. It's a long parable that will consume most of our time here together. It's the story of how my family and I ended up at Frontline. No, that's not quite honest enough. It's actually the story of how I stopped being a professor of theology and a pastor. And while every chapter of this story could expand to hours worth of commentary, I'm assuming you're not willing to give me hours worth of commentary, and so I've kind of got to go right at it. So how should we begin? Once upon a time, many years ago, while a professor at a seminary, and more importantly to this story, a preaching pastor in a church very much like this one, I had determined to help a single mother and her children avoid foreclosure on their home. And over the course of the many months of working closely together with this woman, I lost completely track of personal boundaries. Became very fixated on her family's need and then later on her as a person. It very quickly, my marriage began to deteriorate. as I became more and more emotionally attached to this woman. Now, for those of you who've heard me preach before here, this is actually the context in which that clinical depression that we've talked about when I've talked about depression things, this was actually the environment in which it thrived and kind of became what it was, just to put all that in context. After several months of internal warfare and battling, I determined that I needed to break off the relationship, but I could not, and it got worse. It began to affect my health. I stopped sleeping. I stopped eating. I lost a fifth of my body weight in 6 months. I grew desperate inside, wanting both to continue this emotional addiction. I don't know what else to call it. Part of me even wanting it to become something even more wretched. And a part of me that desperately wanted to be free of it at the same time. And any of you that have ever struggled with any kind of addictive or obsessive behavior knows that it is possible to want both things at the same time. Now, I want you to hear me clearly. I do not mean that the goal of this is in no way to imply that I was not responsible for my actions. I was, I am, they're mine, and I own them. Don't mishear me, that's not the point of today. Nor is it my goal here to even speculate on the other party's motives in this. Their intentions, to this day, I still don't fully understand them. I don't know if it was some combination of vast carelessness or something more sinister. I don't know. As Aslan says in The Horse and His Boy by C.S. Lewis, no one has ever told any story but his own. So that's what I have this morning. My own. Well, I ended up in counseling. I mean, the works, psychotherapy, CBD, CBT, antidepressants, the whole shemale. And all the while, standing behind a music lectern like this every Sunday, preaching a sermon, trying simply not to implode in front of everybody. Well, anybody who's ever been anywhere near something like this knows that this state of affairs cannot continue forever. Something has to give. And I fully expected it to be my health, my sanity, my marriage, even after a couple of close calls, perhaps even my life. That's how borderline I was at moments. But God knew that it was going to take a much more directed surgery. And so, there came an evening when I found myself, much like David, standing on the roof of his house in the wrong place in the wrong time. And good motives, by the way, don't mend things a bit. You are judged on your choices, not your intentions. And I made some really, really stupid, foolish choices, which, in the end, amounted to a pretty significant invasion of her privacy at her home. And the next thing I knew, I was standing in front of a judge in a courtroom. Now, that's actually not true, because when I say the next thing I knew, I just edited two of the longest months of my life down to a single sentence because I'm assuming you want to get to lunch at some point. And that moment's folly snowballed into the end of my professional life and my public good name. I, of course, resigned my position at the church when I realized this was not survivable. And I left a real mess in the lap of those poor men, those elders, who had to try to now do something with this increasingly public scandal. And of course, the university at which I taught could not in good conscience allow me to continue teaching, so, and this actually is kind of funny now, that HR meeting that I'd set up to talk about one thing, you know what's coming, it wasn't actually that one thing. I walked in, there was a lawyer there, some of you have been in those meetings, that the HR meeting is actually the other meeting, and that's how that went. And suddenly I was unemployed, unemployable, sitting alone in my house with nothing to do and no real future ahead of me, learning slowly that lesson that the great 20th century theologian T. Petty taught us, that waiting is the hardest part. Now, if this were an episode of This American Life, or if this were a Moth radio stage, I would say this is the end of part one. Part two might be called The Fallout. But again, I don't want you to misunderstand me here. The whole point of this story is not to talk about me. It's to get to part three. The first two story parts, the icky parts of the story, serve to get me there. Because the goal of this is to talk about Jesus' words, which we are going to do. And so, part two, fallout. There was a lot of that. As I have often said to others in many contexts since then, you get to pick your choices. You do not get to pick your consequences. They are going to be what they're going to be. And no amount of belly aching is going to change it. Well, the only one of those consequences that really matters to this story here are the relational consequences. That our lives, which were at one time very full of people and busyness, were now very silent and isolated. The elders had indicated that I was welcome to attend services again, welcome to come back to services if I met a list of requirements. Which, unfortunately, given the legal process I was in, was not something I could do. I had a lawyer talking to my writer going, you can't say that. You can't say that. You can't stand up in public and say this. If I had it to do over, I would have ignored my lawyer. Not the safest thing to do, but sometimes the right thing. So we went 6 months with very little to no contact with that community, and while the legal stuff wrapped up, and I mean, you know the dictum, out of sight, out of mind. By the time that 6 months had rolled by, there were very few relationships there that existed were salvageable. And the HR policies, of course, at the institution, the university, had more or less cut off relationship there with former co-workers and, of course, students. And most of our long-term friends had just sort of left us to our grief. And I want you to understand this now, FYI, for when you find yourself there. Good people will do this out of good intentions. They will give you space. But if everybody does that, space feels more like outer space. A few of our closest friends even advised Denise to leave me, to throw me out, end the marriage, and move on, which I do not deny she had the right to do. But she'd already made it clear she wanted to put it back together, that a divorce, a separation, whatever, would benefit nobody. It would just make everything harder and worse. And so the continued sort of advocacy in that direction was not only insensitive, but downright destructive to her and ended more than one friendship. And so a cone of silence, a sort of get smart kind of proportions, descended over our family. And I confess, I began to be embittered. Understand, this is how my brain was working in the moment. If we were going to be fair to this, you'd have to bring every one of these people that I've referred to up here and give them a microphone and let them talk, because this is one version of the events. It's mine. That's it. And I know this story would look very different if you were to bring any one of these people up here. But in my mind at the moment, I was in a bad way. Many years now later after it, I can understand the values behind each of those steps that the people took. The great playwright David Mamet, he once wrote that while it is the artist's job to create, it is the institution's job to continue. That really is, for our institutions, the most deeply held value. They don't know it, they won't say it, they would deny it publicly, but it is. To exist, to continue. Institutions fight for their survival with the same primal ferocity of any living thing. And I was no longer an asset. I was a threat. I concede all of that to be true. And yet, I felt, are you listening? Here it comes. I felt judged. People who knew few of the details, little of the truth, had weighed me in their balances and found me worthless, unsalvageable, unwanted, a liability. And while I know their intentions were never to harm, the act of passing judgment with its seemingly final and irreversible verdict very nearly destroyed me. But then it began to take on surreal turns. We attempted to find other churches, places to go to just sort of hang out. And of course, West Michigan's a small town, small area. People, you know, versions of my story were all out there and everything. So, I mean, I'd have to go and sit down with I had to sit down with a pastor because I don't want to create chaos in your congregation. I don't want to create churn. So can my family come? We just need a place to heal up and rest. Can we come here? And we actually, the response we got back were things like, well, let me talk to my elders and see if we're able to accommodate a person in your situation. okay, don't bother. I had a couple of books that I'd written at various stages of publication that were then suspended. My editor told me, he says, but Christians aren't going to buy your books now. Not with your public profile. And of course, no publisher's going to touch them because, of course, publishers are institutions and institutions must survive. So now the bitterness had become a kind of infernal rage inside me because it wasn't just people in my story, friends, parishioners, colleagues who had kind of cast me off. It was now Christians in general. It was just people out there who'd never heard of me, knew nothing of the story. The church at large was now going to judge me and decide that my books, my words, my life, my contribution, all of that was valueless. Remember, this is rage talking. That's the square I was standing in back there. Consequently, I was done. I was done with the church. You can have it. Take it. I was not done with God. God and I were actually in a bit of a renaissance, a bit of a reconciliation. So the depression, the obsession, the anxiety, all of that had broken, it had gone, and the pressure of it all had kind of cracked it like an egg, and I was myself again, and I was like enjoying, like, wow, I like being myself. My marriage was kind of coming back together. I had my family again. And God and I were doing really well. I was actually feeling some gratitude, right? This is wretched, but oh, thank God I'm not back there anymore in the midst of all of that. But God's people, I had no use for them because they had no use for me. And so that judgment begat judgment in return. And we were all probably dead wrong about each other. But I want you to hear Jesus' words anew now. Judge not, lest ye be judged. For in the way you judge, you will be judged, and by your standard it will be measured to you. Now, notice here, nothing in Jesus' words here indicates that the judgment that he's talking about is a divine judgment. God isn't mentioned anywhere in here. It's not necessarily that he's saying, like, if you are a judgmental person and judge people, God will judge you more harshly. I suppose he could mean that. It's not out of the realm of possibility, but that's not necessarily what he means. He may merely be describing what we actually do to each other when we pass judgment. The sorrow and the pain that we visit upon each other when we draw these final conclusions about people's place and value and worth, what does it do? We cause them in the midst of their pain and rejection to what? Revisit that same scorn back upon us. It's all perfectly predictable. When we judge, we beget judgment. No one can ever say Jesus didn't know, did not understand fallen human nature. Though he did not have one himself, he still knows us better than we know ourselves. Well, that's the second part of the story. I hope shades of Jesus' meaning are starting to glimmer at the fringes of your vision. So now we move to part three. I told you there's a happy ending coming, and now we get to hopefully get to see it. I learned something. When faced with another person's trouble, with another person's sorrow, another person's chaos, another person's bad choices, whatever, I've learned there are two kinds of people. There are those who run away, and there are those who run toward. And I've done my share of running away. Because just about all the people in our lives ran away. But I told you there was a happy ending because there was a few people who did run toward. There were a couple of friends, a few families who stayed with us. Our own families were supportive. And that was all key. But there were also a couple of pastoral types who they deserve to be named. Sharon Brown, her and her husband Jack were at the time pastors down at Redeemer Covenant Church in Dutton. And she and I co-taught the spiritual formation course at the seminary. She knew and she stepped forward. And Dave Beelan, pastor at Madison Square Christian Reformed Church downtown, who I know because we'd spoken at conferences together and things. They both just unsolicited stepped out of the shadows and gave us the right kind of space. Space that still includes presence. They just sat down in the ash heap with us. And their response was very different than what I was used to. They assigned no value to me whatsoever. They, of course, didn't condone the thing I had done, the choices I'd made. And sometimes they even said really hard things to me that had to be said. But most importantly, they gave me this kind of room, the room to grieve, without adding additional guilt and shame. They were mostly silent and mostly present. They allowed God to do the work that needed to be done, where repentance was needed, where healing was needed, where honesty was needed. Do not underestimate, my friend, the value of mere presence. But I was still pretty embittered toward the church and the people in it. So when Denise came to me and said, well, the kids still need church. They still need to go to church somewhere. I said, fine, go. Go to as many churches as you want. Let me know if you find something interesting. So one Sunday she came home and said, well, I found a place. The kids really like it and it feels okay. So now I was hooked. I had to go because I told her. And it was fine. It was okay. Actually, I was a little taken with the fellow who preached that Sunday. I think his name was Brian. Is that right? He was so straightforward. He was so honest, reflective, and genuine. He's such a gift. Because I'm not. I'm all like, you know, show tunes and stage presence and, you know, like all the actor in me and all that coming out. And Brian is exactly the same person down there as he is up here. It's rare, and it's so powerful. Well, I called, like I was my habit. I called, and who do I make an appointment with? And ended up Blake and Brian were the people, and sat down at Big B's, and I told them my story and concluded with my usual, so, my family needs a place to heal. Is it okay for us to be at Frontline for a bit? And I waited. And they looked at each other, and they looked at me and said, what do you mean, can you come to Frontline? They were actually mystified by my concern. Of course you're welcome to come to Frontline. I mean, this is the church. The church exists for people like you. And then Brian knocked the pegs out from under me completely by saying, oh, by the way, we have this little team of people that work on the sermons. They do post-mortem afterwards, how'd it go, and talk about where we're headed next. And he says, you know, with your background and your skills, you might, if you wanted, be welcome to join us for a spell and see if you like it. And now it was my turn to look at him askance, because it sounded to me like he was saying that, like there was still actually something for me to do. Some way to contribute, something that I was still welcome to be a part of. And they weren't reeling, you know, trying to find a way to respond appropriately. They were actually simply just used to talking to people who screwed up their lives. Isn't that why the church exists? And so here we are. But there's one more layer I've got to peel off. The onion's got one more layer on it that I got to peel off before I can give you sort of Jesus with all of his barbed intensity. Because a few weeks later, Brian and I met for coffee again, and he told me a story of his life, and he subsequently told it here, and he said it was okay for me to refer to it, that how a number of years ago in his life, he too had walked up to the edge of that cliff that I'd pole vaulted off. He told me about a relationship in his life with a lady that had really started to go sideways in some really bad ways. And how my story was, in some ways, the story of where he was headed. Had not some dear friends sort of corralled him and pulled him back? And if the elders, the leadership team here at Frontline, had not sort of surrounded and brought him there and worked redemptively with him to get him healthy again and for all their work, you still have your pastor. But now we come to it, out of that story. Brian had been forced to spend time reflecting upon the dark things in his own heart. He had suffered, and he had learned from his suffering. And because he'd been faithful to face the demons of his own choices, to do the hard work and learn the humbling lessons that pain, and it seems only pain, can teach us. And because of that intentional scrutiny of his own weaknesses, it changed his response forever to people like me. It prepared him to sit down across from me, years in advance. Because, are you listening? Because he'd been faithful in dealing with, facing, and staring down the junk in his own eye, he could now clearly see to help another who was struggling with blindness. Listen again to Jesus' words. Why do you look at the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, and behold, you've got a log in your own eye, you hypocrite. First take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. Don't misunderstand Jesus. Jesus does not say here that that speck, that sliver of wood or whatever in your brother's eye has permission to remain. He never says that the speck is okay, no big deal, that it's not wrong, that it's not sin, that it's not painful to the fellow. Any of you who's ever had a speck in your eye knows it hurts like Hades. Specks need to get out. They're awful. They're miserable. Jesus says, do not judge does not mean never bother about anybody else's eyes because it's none of your business. You begin to feel the cultural divide? What he is saying is that if you pass final judgment on that person and walk away, yes, you are a hypocrite because you do not see the areas of your own life that stand in need of similar redemption. Jesus offers us an invitation. Address the crap in your own situation. Confront the demons of your own past and present. Clean out your own house. Face the shame and the embarrassment of your own dirty dishes. By God's grace, that's what I'm doing. Step of faith, Lord. Drag the skeletons out of your closet, look them in the eye holes, and admit the fact that you put them in there and shut the door. And then you will be in a position to help your brother or sister remove the splinter from their own eye. And precisely because you will now see more clearly to do so. What will you see more clearly? It's possible that he means the splinter itself. Yes, possibly. It seems to me, however, that Jesus might just as equally mean the thing that you will now see with clarity is the pain that that splinter causes your brother. Specks in the eye are painful. Herein is the great difference. A judge, any judge, can administer justice. That's what judges do. But very few people are healed by naked justice. Few get their lives back because of the work of a judge. Anyone can remove a speck from someone's eye if they don't care about the condition of the eye when they're done. But a physician. Physicians actually don't care about specks. They care about eyes. The doctor is more concerned with preserving the eye. Jesus doesn't want us to merely stop being judges of others, stop passing judgment on the value and worth of other people in their chaos. Yes, but Jesus wants a positive step too. Stop being a judge, start being a doctor. Jesus does want the speck removed from every eye. Jesus does want every eye to see clearly. Blindness is not a quality of the kingdom. How many times did Jesus heal blind people in order to teach us that? If we love each other as we should, as brothers and sisters in Christ, or if we love the world and its despairing people at all, we are going to have to speak hard words. Many a painful splinter will have to be removed. Jesus is not telling us to leave each other alone. That is not love. That is apathy. Love must make judgments. Love interferes. Do you love your kids? For God's sake, interfere. Jesus wants us to make the judgments of a physician who wishes to diagnose and heal, not that of a judge whose job it is to condemn. And so, my friends, this forces upon us a couple of questions for our consideration. One, who do you think is unredeemable? About whom do you see all the dirt, all the junk, all the specks, but it's never occurred to you to think about their eyes? And second, what comparable chaos in your own life are you ignoring that keeps you from seeing it? How often do we hear it, right? You'll hear whole ethnic groups bombasted for being, I don't know, pick the insult du jour, for being what, lazy or violent or racist or whatever, while leaving entirely unconsidered the prejudices of your own heart. Or you read something like, well, gay people are just, again, fill in the blank with the insult du jour. Well, people are much less willing to consider their own heterosexual lusts, their own heterosexual fornications, and their own heterosexual obsessions. Are these less a problem? Or generations do it to one another, right? older, the younger, greatest generation says it. You read, right? Millennials. Ugh. They're just self-centered and narcissistic. And it goes completely unnoticed that the venue in which the observation is being made is Facebook. The love child of Narcissus with his own reflection. Now, it's true, the gospel has loads to say to our ethnic identity, has loads to say to our sexuality, to our particular generational stratification, all these, and those things have to be said. That's the gospel. But Jesus asks us, do we say them as a judge or do we say them as a physician? Do we say them as an executioner or as a fellow criminal? Do we say them as an enemy seeking occasion or a friend seeking wholeness? When we see another, a brother or sister in a fault, struggling, sorrowing, broken, self-deceived, do we run away in a manner that underscores our own moral superiority so that we may keep our hands clean? Or do we run humbly toward? What is the motive behind all of our uproar? In the end, which do we care more about? Specks of dirt or people's eyes?